Case number 21-5760, United States of America versus Shane Begley. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Guernsey, if you want to make some opening remarks from the podium.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Allison Guernsey, and I am the director of the Federal Criminal Defense Clinic at the University of Iowa and supervisor of Ms. Audrey Felderman, who's been authorized to present oral argument on behalf of Shane Begley.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case is about one number and the conclusion that followed from its premise. That was the basis for an effectively 30-month above-the-guideline sentence in today's case. The district court erred in denying Mr. Begley's 3582C2 motion, and this court should reverse for two reasons. First, the district court committed procedural and constitutional error when it relied on unreliable information in denying Mr. Begley's motion to conclude that he was more likely than not to be rearrested. Second, the district court imposed a substantively unreasonable sentence by double counting Mr. Begley's criminal history. Because the government has waived any claim processing issues under Section 3742A, if the court has no questions on this issue, I will move on to the substance of my argument. The district court procedurally erred when it relied on one generalized statistic to conclude that Mr. Begley was 63.3% likely to be rearrested, and as a result, was not entitled to a sentence reduction. The statistic was solely based on Mr. Begley's status as a criminal history Category 3, and did not consider Mr. Begley's other characteristics as required.
You're not contending that the statement itself is false?
No, Your Honor, we're not. And in fact, we don't dispute that 63.3% rearrest statistic is a true statistic by itself. However, we are arguing that it's unreliable as applied to Mr. Begley. In order to show procedural error, Mr. Begley must show first that the information the district court was relied upon was either materially false or unreliable, and second, that the challenge statistic served as a basis for the sentencing decision, or simply that the decision might have been different absent the statistic. While we don't dispute that the 63.3% rearrest statistic might be materially true in and of itself, it's unreliable when applied to Mr. Begley in isolation, without considering the other statistics in the same report that are a more accurate reflection of Mr. Begley's 3553A characteristics.
Were those other statistics brought up to the judge?
In the briefing before the district court, there were several other statistics, and that included the BOP's pattern score, which reflected a low risk of recidivism, 24% lower risk of rearrest based on Mr. Begley's work for Unicor, and the statistic that reflects that because of his age category, Mr. Begley is within the least likely of those to be rearrested. And those statistics were presented before the district court.
And so you're saying that the district judge needed to say something about those statistics specifically in order to say that he had considered them?
Your Honor, the district court's decision was unreliable because what it did was rely on the 63.3% in isolation. And in having done so, not only did it not consider the statistics that we presented before the court, but there were several other statistics in that same 2016 report that it failed to consider. And in doing so, it looks at that statistic in a vacuum, and not only that statistic, but what that statistic represents. And that statistic represents that Mr. Begley was more likely than not to be rearrested. And in relying on just that one statistic when there were more in there, that cuts against this court's decision in Daniels, which requires an individualized analysis.
So is your answer that the court did need to specifically say, I've also considered these other numbers that you've given me, and I don't think that it changes my analysis that I think this guy's likely to reoffend or whatever his conclusion is?
Your Honor, it's our position that when statistics are presented before the district court, if the district court wishes to rely on these statistics promulgated by the Sentencing Commission, it's the duty of the district courts to make them reliable. And to do so, you have to look at all of the statistics in the report presented before it and those statistics presented by counsel. And the district court failed to do that here. And because they failed to do that, they relied on this statistic. And similarly, we can think about it in a sports hypothetical where if you're relying on one statistic, whether it be of the best game or the worst game in a season, it's not reflective of that season, this team's season as a whole. And in relying on just one statistic, you don't get a whole picture of what that team looks like on the whole season. Similarly here.
What do we do about the fact that this statistic in the order was just in the footnote, which doesn't seem to suggest that it served as the basis for the district court's decision here?
Your Honor, I have 2 points to make in response. And first is that it doesn't have to have served as the basis, only that it has to be a basis. And we can look and see that in this court's decision in Adams as well as Wilson. But second, the footnote, it does appear in the footnote on page 4 of the order. However, to characterize it as a footnote, I believe is misplaced, because although it is a footnote, it takes up a substantial portion of the district court's order, comprising nearly 360 words to a 500-word analysis section of the district court's order. So it is substantial. And not only is it expressly mentioned in the district court's order in that footnote, we can see it several instances above the line in the district court's order, in fact, 4 instances. First, we can see that the court used this as a basis for the decision because it focused on the fact that this was not Mr. Begley's first conviction for a controlled substance offense. Because the district court believed he was more likely than not to be rearrested, he was therefore an increased danger to the community given a previous conviction. Second, we can see that although the district court noted that Mr. Begley's criminal history isn't particularly egregious, it noted that what little is there reflects a lack of respect for the law. Because the district court believed he was more likely than not to be rearrested, this increased risk of safety presented a higher risk of respect of lack for the law. Third, because
the fact that the judge thought it was a likelihood that he was going to be rearrested wasn't just based on that statistic. It was based on specific things that the defendant had done, his criminal history and when he picked up that criminal history. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, that's true in that it also, not only the problem with relying on the statistic in isolation is that there was procedural error, there's also substantive unreasonableness in that the district court's imposition or failure to modify imposes a substantively unreasonable sentence in that it effectively imposes a 30-month above the guideline sentence. And in doing so, it double counts Mr. Begley's criminal history that had already been factored into the guideline range as amended after 782. And in doing so, not only does it double count Mr. Begley's criminal history, but it fails to appropriately weigh the need to avoid unwarranted sentences.
I don't follow the argument that it double counts the criminal history. The guidelines modified the offense level. It didn't impact the criminal history. How is it double counted?
Your Honor, the criminal history points were calculated for in the original guideline sentence, and so in relying so heavily on Mr. Begley's criminal history in the district court's order, it re-emphasizes and double counts that criminal history, as this court noted in Lee, double counts the
technically double counts, or just gives undue emphasis, in your opinion?
It gives undue emphasis to the criminal history at both levels. And the criminal history was factored into this amended guideline range. And so to impose a sentence 30 months above this amended guideline range is simply too long. And it also doesn't weigh the factor of avoiding unwarranted sentencing disparities, as other individuals in criminal history category 3 that were sentenced several years after Mr. Begley, 98% of those individuals received a lower sentence. So only 2% of individuals received an above-the-guideline sentence. And that was Mr. Begley in this case. And because the district court both procedurally erred and substantively erred, we would ask that this court vacate and remand for reconsideration. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Ben Hurst for the United States. The district court did not abuse its discretion in declining to reduce the defendant's sentence. Defendant primarily complains about the district court's citation in a footnote at the very end of a five-page opinion to a statistic from the Sentencing Commission that offenders with criminal history category 3 are rearrested at a 63.3% rate. But that statistic was not an important factor in a district court's decision, nor was it materially false or unreliable. And therefore, the government would ask this court to affirm. First, the district court did not make that statistic an important factor in its decision. Reviewing the district court's opinion as a whole, it's important to consider first what the district court considered first, the seriousness of the offense that the defendant committed. And that's not in dispute here, so we don't see a lot of briefing about that, but that's because the parties agree that this is a serious offense, and the district court recognized that. And that goes to not only the need for specific deterrence of this defendant, which is what we've been discussing, but also the need for general deterrence and the need to form a sentence that imposes a just punishment. I mean, here, the offense was very serious. The defendant was moving a lot of methamphetamine that was high quality into a vulnerable population area. And the district court recognized that in declining to reduce his sentence here.
Did the district court specifically mention general and specific deterrence in this order?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, but that would be one of the bases for moving forward on why the seriousness of the offense is important, is for both of those purposes. Furthermore, the district court considered the district defendant's individual characteristics in deciding that it would be inappropriate to reduce his sentence here in order to protect the public. The district court specifically considered the fact that the defendant had a prior drug offense, that the defendant received a lenient sentence for that prior drug offense, and that the defendant reoffended, in fact, absconded from supervision. And that was why the district court came to the conclusion that the defendant's criminal history reflects a lack of respect for the law, and importantly, a failure to comply with the conditions of supervision. Those are the factors the district court discusses up front in its opinion, and those are the factors that were driving the district court's decision in this case. Contrast that with the way that this statistic in the footnote became a part of the district court's opinion. The defendant was the one who suggested that the district court consider age as a mitigating factor, and that the defendants, the district courts should consider the Sentencing Commission report on the statistic in that report, that those who are released at the age the defendant would be if he received the reduced sentence that he'd requested have a lower rate of recidivism. And the district court responding to that noted that in that same report, there is an additional statistic for criminal history category. And the district court said, look, I've got to consider a host of factors. It's not appropriate to pick one statistic that's perceived to be favorable to the defendant and ignore the statistics that are less favorable in the defendant's view, as we see in this appeal. So considering the way that the district court used that statistic is not the driving force in its decision, but rather in responding to the defendant's argument from a similar statistic in the same report. For that reason, we think the district court did not make the statistic an important factor in its decision. But furthermore, the statistic was not materially false or unreliable. The defendant is conceded today that it's not arguing that this district court cited an incorrect statistic. It's not even really challenging the Sentencing Commission's analysis of the data that created that statistic, but is instead suggesting that the district court can't rely on one statistic unless it takes into account all of the various factors that might come to relevance in deciding whether a particular defendant is a risk to recidivate. But that's, for one point, that's sort of what the district court did when it was discussing the factors. But two, it's unreasonable and has never been a requirement that the district court go to the Sentencing Commission, get the 24,000 observation data set, and run a multivariate regression of all the different potential factors that the defendant, that could be relevant to a particular defendant's risk of recidivism, and then consider the defendant's individual characteristics. That's not reasonable. That's not what's required. Not something that, and it's difficult, frankly, to see how to comply with what the defendant is arguing here, what the district court should have done without going to those lengths. Here, what the district court did with that statistic, didn't use it in a materially false or unreliable way. And the district court, and this court should affirm for that reason as well. I'll just make an additional note on the, I'll make an additional note on one point that I heard. I don't read the district court as concluding that the defendant had a 63.3% likelihood to reoffend. I think what the district court is trying to do with all of these analysis is to say there's an unknown out there. What is this particular defendant's likelihood to reoffend? How do I craft a sentence that protects the public in light of that? That's an analysis that requires, as the district court correctly noted, a host of factors. Here, as this court's noted, in Adams in particular, an analysis of the defendant's individual characteristics, his own previous rate of recidivism, and furthermore, the need to consider all of the, perhaps in this case, the statistics that the defendant provided. But those are all things that the defendant has to, or that the district court has to consider in trying to analyze what the correct rate of recidivism is. And I think that would take me to the point about substantive reasonableness. And this is a very fact-specific inquiry. The district court is looking at all the defendant's individual characteristics as well as the statistics that the defendant provided. Here, it's...
It seems to me that, for substantive reasonableness, what weight do you give as a district judge to the fact that the sentencing guideline range has gone down significantly, 52 months here? It just seems like the district judge is kind of making his decision about what the sentence should be without regard to what the sentencing range is. And because, I mean, it's the same judge who'd sentenced him before, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah. But I guess the judge under Booker doesn't really have to consider the guideline range here. I mean, how does that play into this? What in the 3553 factors, what's he finding that makes it? Here he's going above the guideline range, whereas before he was not. What's he pointing to say that he can go above the guideline range here?
Your Honor, I think it's the district court. Response to the question that Your Honor has posed is that the district court starts with the guideline range. That's the starting point. The guidelines weren't driving this sentence in the first place.
Doesn't seem like it.
And so, Your Honor, I think the district court goes through the explanation of why it believes that's the case in the footnote, earlier in the footnote that we've been discussing, and explains that guidelines are an important starting place, but I need to craft a sentence that's sufficient but not greater than necessary to meet the sentencing sentencing statute's requirements. And that's what the district court was doing here. So that the guidelines may have shifted, I don't think is irrelevant. I think the district court considered that. It did write a lengthy opinion about it. But I think in the grand analysis, not just recidivism, but the entire 3553 analysis, the district court's not looking specifically to the guidelines.
I guess
Go ahead.
What I was going to say is it seems like if you're going to go above the guideline range, you need to find something to make this case kind of out of the ordinary. I guess I'm having some trouble understanding what he's saying about this case that makes it out of the ordinary of what you normally expect for this guideline range of this offense.
Well, Your Honor, I think there's several things to look at in the opinion. The district court noted, and this kind of goes to the point that counsel was making about double counting. There are factors that are not taken into account in the guidelines range, but that the district court noted. This defendant began his amounted only criminal history category 3, but he started to accumulate that criminal history category very late in his life. So the guidelines will account for the criminal history category, but don't account for the speed at which the defendant accumulated his criminal history points. So that's one thing that the court could consider, did discuss that. Discussed the fact that the defendant received a lenient sentence the first time around. The fact that the defendant received a lenient sentence and was not deterred from future offenses is something that the district court considered in this case and would not be accounted for completely in the guidelines. So I think there's things that the district court was looking at here beyond just what the guidelines were that set this case a little bit apart. If there are no additional questions.
That's all from me.
The government would rest on its briefs and would ask this court to affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you.
May it please the court. I have 6 points to make in response to counsel's arguments. And first, I'd like to start with the standard of review. Opposing counsel articulated that the standard of review is abuse of discretion, and while that is true for the procedural and substantive unreasonableness claims, we've also put forth a constitutional due process argument. And the standard of review under that is de novo. So if this court finds that an abuse of discretion, it doesn't meet the abuse of discretion standard, it may still find a constitutional error under the de novo standard.
The due process claim is based on the statistic issue, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the due process claim mirrors the procedural unreasonableness test in that it must be unreliable and materially false, as well as serve as a basis. And so the de novo standard of review would easily be substitutable for those arguments. Second, the factors that the district court relied on reflect the district court's reliance on the unreliable characteristics. And as my opposing counsel stated, it's not appropriate to rely on only one factor. And that's not what we would ask that this court do. While whether it be the lowest factor, lowest statistic in the 2016 report being that because of his age, Mr. Begley is only 20% likely to rearrest, or that because of his age, because of the criminal history category, he would be 60% likely to rearrest. It's unreliable to rely on either one of those, and that is the procedural error that happened in the district court's analysis. Third, because the Daniels requires an individualized analysis, although the district court went through the 3553A analysis, it went through the 3553A analysis with this deeply held belief that Mr. Begley was more likely than not to be rearrested. And we can see that at several instances in the district court's order, and that's the reliance on this 63% rearrest rate. And Daniels requires an individualized analysis. Fourth, we're not asking that this court articulate a rule that would require district courts to analyze all these statistics and conduct a regression analysis. We're not asking for something that is unworkable at the district court level. However, where the district court wants to raise these statistics that are promulgated by the Sentencing Commission sua sponte, it's the district court's duty to make them reliable. And in doing so, it can't simply rely on one of these statistics. It must rely on all of the statistics that are in interest before it, as well as those that are presented by counsel. And that adheres to Daniels, and that you're individualizing that analysis to that individual defendant, as opposed to relying on these statistics mechanically and in a vacuum. To vary upward outside of the guidelines range, Lee would require that this court show either a uniquely problematic criminal history or that there be a meaningful relationship to the offense of conduct. And in this case, going to the substantive unreasonableness, the district court isn't able to establish that Mr. Begley represents either of those two characteristics. So to impose effectively impose a 30-month above the guideline sentence without establishing that uniquely problematic criminal history or this meaningful relationship is to impose a sentence that is far too long. Finally, reflecting the BOP's decision that Mr. Begley is at a low risk of recidivism, we would just like to articulate that Mr. Begley has been released on home confinement now for 14 months. And we would ask that this court take judicial notice that he's in the courtroom today. And his presence in the courtroom today reflects the unreliability of that 63% rearrest rate, in that we can't rely on these statistics in a vacuum. Because after obtaining the BOP's permission to be here today, it shows that it is not more likely than not that Mr. Begley was to be rearrested. If the court has no further questions, we would just ask that the court vacate and remand for reconsideration of Mr. Begley's motion. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate the arguments both of you have given. We'll consider the case carefully. We appreciate the Iowa Clinic's participation and the student argument, and are glad to have had the opportunity, that you had the opportunity and that we did.